Walter's Professor of Philosophy and Hardy Professor for Legal Studies at Dartmouth, and most importantly, I think at the moment, co-director of this new MacArthur Law Neuroscience Project. And for those of you who work in these areas, you'll know that he's taken on this huge task and has just published 3 edited volumes on the evolution, cognitive science, and neuroscience of morality. A great service to all of us. Thank you, Walter.
Well, thank you. I wanted to start by thanking Roger for arranging such a wonderful thing and all of you for being so interesting and inspiring. I've really learned a great deal from you during these sessions, and I look forward to learning even more. I'm one of those guys who always did the assignment. You know, the teacher says, bring a candle to the dark, so I actually have a candle in the dark. But first, I got to explain to you what the dark is. The dark in the legal system, at least the part of the dark that bothers me, is in the criminal law. There are just way too many people in prison in the United States. I mean, I just think that's so obvious, I didn't even bother to put the numbers up. Everybody knows there are too many people, especially too many people from certain communities. You know, one story that I heard is that because the state of Alabama says that if you've committed a felony, you're no longer eligible to vote for the rest of your life, there are now more black males disenfranchised in the state of Alabama than before the Voting Rights Act. And so we've got a real problem here. But there's also too much crime outside the prisons, on the streets. People, you know, some communities are fairly safe. I live in Hanover, there's not a lot of crime, but I hear in other places there's actually crime going on out there, and that people are scared. And so there's a real problem that the prisons are supposed to be solving. But citizens are scared and they're frustrated that the problem is not getting solved as fast as they would like. So what they do is they fumble around in the dark, right? They pass laws like 3 strikes and you're out, because they think that if you've done 3 felonies, you're irredeemable and we've got to get you off the streets because you're the dangerous ones. They're not using science. They're using this crude, you know, 3 times and you're out. They've limited defenses, such as the insanity defense, saying that you can't have the volitional prong in the model penal code rule. Why? Because the psychiatrists just come in and argue on both sides and you can't trust them and you can't figure out which one's right, and so we got to just not let anybody off because we haven't figured out a good way to determine really who does have the capacity to conform to law. We also get strict sentencing guidelines where the legislatures say we don't trust the courts, because the courts have made, you know, numerous stupid decisions, and so they pass these sentencing guidelines to restrict the courts, but those guidelines are not based on the best scientific information either. Instead, you just get longer and longer sentences to try to keep people off the street longer so they'll do less crime, which is not, again, a very scientific way of going about it. I mentioned verdicts based on symmetry because a friend of mine, Eyal Aharoni, just did a very interesting study where he found out that the verdicts are based on arbitrary factors, not race or sex. Whether your face is symmetrical will determine what you're found guilty of and how long the sentence is, because they're not based, again, on the factors they ought to be. And parole boards often will admit, you know, we're just guessing as to who it's safe to parole and who it's not safe to parole. So the candle is science. Science might be able to step in and find a better way to solve these problems in the criminal law. I'm particularly interested in neuroscience. Of course, neuroscience by itself is not going to tell you anything. You've got to get the correlations with the behavioral studies and cognitive science and social sciences, criminology, and so on, of various sorts. But neuroscience is where the focus is for our project. Where should we put the candle? I should add, by the way, our project, I'm speaking now for myself, not for the project or for the MacArthur Foundation or anything like that. I should add that qualification. Where should we put the candle? Well, that's a strategic question. We might say, well, we want to bring science into the legislature because the legislature can reform the whole legal system very quickly. And of course, they can use group data, which is going to be much more reliable in a way because they're passing general laws for groups. The problems are that voters distrust science and they fear criminals, so they're often unreceptive to science-based reforms. And this makes elected legislators particularly reluctant to institute reforms that scientists suggest, at least in this area, not in all areas, but at least in this area. Another idea would be to put the candle not up at the top, but down at the bottom in the courts. The bottom only in the sense that they deal with individual cases. The courts, we have found, are very receptive to science. When we have run neuroscience for judges weekends, they're always oversubscribed, and they're just hundreds of people that want to, you know, come in and learn this stuff. They're looking for help. They're eager. They're hungry. And I've heard, although I have less personal experience, I've heard that parole boards are also. So they might be more receptive than working through legislatures. The problem, of course, is that it takes a long time to solve social problems if you're just doing it case by case. And it costs more money than the courts and parole boards have. The legislatures can come up with the money, but the courts and parole boards are often more limited. And also, another problem we'll see is that it requires individual applications of group data, and most of the science so far is group data. So it's going to be tricky to use science in that arena, but there's at least some hope. What could the candle illuminate to drive this metaphor into the ground? Which criminals are more likely to commit serious crimes again if they're not kept in prison? If you could get a prediction of that, of the likelihood of this individual committing another serious crime, which criminals can be released? They're not likely to. They're likely to go along without creating much danger to the public at all. And which alternatives to prison are going to work for which criminals? Because there are alternatives. Drug courts have been used. Other kinds of alternatives have been suggested. And how could it be used? Well, if you can predict who's more likely to commit a serious crime, then you could give longer sentences to those dangerous convicts at the time of conviction, or you could deny parole after serving the minimum sentence before parole, or possibly even some people have suggested preventive detention after serving the sentence for the crime. That's controversial, but the one that's rarely accepted, and I certainly would not accept, is involuntary commitment without some kind of prior criminal conviction. So there are legal and moral and questions that need to be addressed as to how you're going to use the information, but the first step I want to talk about is getting the information, and I want to focus on psychopaths. There are many other addicts and many other groups that should be addressed under similar ways, but I want to focus on psychopaths. What do I mean by psychopaths? Well, we're talking about 1% of the general population. We've found about 20% in medium security prison populations, although in juvenile facilities that go into higher security ratings, we're getting more like around 40%, and we haven't looked at high security prison populations yet. The estimate is that they commit 30 to 50% of the violent crime in our country, of the serious violent crime in our country. And that estimate comes from the fact that on self-report, they usually admit to about four times as many crimes as the non-psychopathic criminals. How do they get diagnosed? Well, you can see that there are two dimensions here. There's the behavioral dimension and the affective dimension. The behavioral dimension is really, you know, promiscuous sexual behavior, early behavior problems, impulsivity, irresponsibility, marital relationships. That stuff's objectively identifiable. The reason this category is not in DSM-4R is partly because of this dimension, which is much harder to assess because it's so subjective. It's trying to, you know, to figure out what's going on in the mind of the psychopath. Glibness, grandiose sense of self-worth, need for stimulation, pathological lying, they're always trying to manipulate you, lack of remorse or guilt, shallow affect, lack of empathy, parasitic lifestyle. Look, if your kids are still living with you after the age of 30, you ought to worry. Poor behavior controls. And so those are very difficult. Bob Hare, has developed a way of assessing this, and you can be trained in it. There's some questions about its reliability, but there's a lot of inter-rater reliability, at least. What's the connection to recidivism? Well, you can see these are the, those aren't marked, but We lost the little labels over here, but the green line is the high psychopathy scores. Yellow is moderate, 20 to 30. Oh, let me go back there because I didn't say. The way this gets rated is each of the 20 factors you get 0, 1, or 2. So the maximum is 40. And you get diagnosed as a psychopath if you have 30 or above. Okay? So now we can go forward. The green line is people who got 30 or above. Yellow is 20 to 30. Red is below 20. And you can see this is days after release. So if you look here, that's like about a year. You've already got 60% of the psychopaths recidivating, committing another crime. And it's down, it's more than 80% by the time you get out to, what's that, about 3 years or so. Three and a little bit. Okay? You might say, well, recidivating could be cashing a bad check. It doesn't have to be something really horrible. But this is violent recidivism, right? And here, notice that's time scale in years. When you get out to about 6 years, you've already got 75% committing another violent felony. So people say it's hard to predict, but there are at least group data here. And of course, that's the low psychopathy, and it's much, much less. Okay? Notice here, by the time you get out to 17 years, it's less than 10% haven't committed another. Okay? By the way, when this area, these figures are probably underestimates as well, because psychopaths tend to move around a lot, and so it's hard to gather the data. This is just the ones that they were able to find out about recidivism. There are a lot that aren't in there, and that explains flat areas where they just couldn't keep up with the subjects. How are we going to make the prediction even better? Well, it seems to me this is where neuroscience can come in to help. There have been found late negativity, EEG readings that are distinctive of psychopaths. In some of the studies, it can hit 10 out of 10 of the psychopaths, and none of the non-psychopathic murderers had that brain pattern. I can go into details if you want, but the basic idea is that if you've got a behavioral scale like here, you got to worry a little bit because you don't know whether they really are feeling guilt or not. I mean, how can you really tell? There's some tests, but they're not terribly reliable. If you only give longer sentences to people who both had the behavioral score and also tested positive on the neural test, then you've got a higher level of reliability. We're doing some further tests here. I'm just talking about work in progress from our law and neuroscience project, or work that's actually just planned and proposed. It's not even under progress yet. But the idea is that you could look at factors that you think might be relevant to recidivism, such as the extent to which they dehumanize other people. Some of you might have seen this article by Fisk and Harris about how Princeton undergrads dehumanize addicts and homeless people in a certain way and show a lower activation in certain areas of the brain when they do so. So we're going to see whether psychopaths do that to all people, and it might be a subset of psychopaths. Same thing for failing to appreciate the moral wrongness of your actions. We've got a proposal for a moral convention, to see whether they really can draw the moral conventional distinction. I mean, of course, Blair did that a while ago, but I think there are problems with that study that we've tried to remedy. We're doing a study of how well they can rank crimes. Robinson and Kurzban at University of Pennsylvania had a set of 24 crimes of varying degrees of severity. As far as pairwise rankings go, he found 96% agreement in his normal subject pool. We're finding that psychopaths aren't able to do that. A subset are not able to do that. And so the point is, since these are all going to be subsets of psychopaths, again, it might be that being in that subset gives you an even higher predictive value for recidivism. So the hope is that by doing these additional studies and coming to understand psychopathy better, we'll be able to predict recidivism better, maybe in the end also develop some kind of treatment, but that's a long way off, obviously, so at this point we're looking at better predictions. Are the predictions good enough? Well, it seems to me that's not a question for scientists. You don't have any particular expertise in that. That's a question for society. We have legal people in our group as well. Before we can give a, what we do agree on, though, is before we can give a longer sentence or deny parole or use preventive detention after conviction, remember, we need to be sure that we've got the right people and that they really are dangerous. And it's difficult to make reliable predictions of particular cases given individual variation. They're not all the same. They're individuals, right? They get over 30, but they score differently on different items on that checklist. And also low base rates. If it's only 1% of the general population, you've got Bayesian problems in applying it and getting predictions out of it. Furthermore, there are ethical issues of fairness that arise. Some people in our group are arguing strongly that, you know, if it's due to genes or maybe if it's due to child abuse, it's not fair to give longer sentences to these people, even though they're dangerous. You know, the people on the other side will respond, we're talking about a group of people that, I mean, one story, just to give you a flavor of it, you know, a person let out of prison goes out for 2 weeks, and in 2 weeks later, he's already back in jail. Well, why is that? Because within 2 weeks, he had committed several violent felonies, robbed a couple of banks, and so on and so on. And he came back, and the scientist, by the way, whose work I'm really reporting here is Kent Keel, and so this person said to Kent, Kent said, how are your 2 weeks out? And he goes, greatest time of my life, right? And yet he just caused mayhem in the community. That's the kind of people we're talking about here. So what's the conclusion? The conclusion is conclusion's got to be conditional because we haven't done the work yet. I'm really speculating here about things that are yet to be done. But if we can use neuroscience combined with behavioral studies to make reliable enough predictions of serious enough recidivism in individual cases, and if the criminal has already been convicted of a serious enough crime, and it's not unfair to keep them longer, right? Those are decisions that we have to make as a society. But then we can reduce crime. We can achieve that goal, at least, by imposing longer sentences, denying parole, adding preventive detention. We got to figure out which method to use, but the methods will be available to us once science provides the prediction, the ability to predict in the individual cases. And then after that, if those people are the most dangerous ones, we will have a better understanding of others might be less dangerous, and then we can give lesser sentences to them, and then we might actually be able to lower the crime rate and also lower the number of people in prison at the same time. And now I take it all back. We're nowhere near being able to do any of this yet, right? And we might never succeed. It's a project that's in progress. As someone said yesterday, all we have so far is a vat of swirling wax. And whether we can make it into a candle, of course, remains to be seen. Thanks.